All right, good morning, everyone. Welcome back to another episode of The Lounge here. We have a special episode here because I'm joined by Michelle and Angelina here to we got a core project that we have to create a podcast talking about food politics. So if you guys want to introduce yourselves, you can.
Hi, listeners of The Lounge. I'm Michelle Peter, and welcome foodies alike.
Hi, I'm Angelina Hawkes.
Nice. So, yeah, we're just going to dive right into the topic. And, yeah, why don't we get started here?
All right. So today we will be talking about government placing regulations on ultra-processed foods. To process a food means to change its natural state, as defined by the U.S. Department of Agriculture, meaning any raw agricultural food that is subject to freezing, drying, canning, etc., is considered a processed commodity. Ultra-processed foods take a further step from the criteria of processed foods. For surrounding to be ultra-processed foods, it means that it can include substances not used in culinary preparations. It most likely has added ingredients and substances extracted from food. Examples include chips, candy, chocolate, ice cream, and breakfast cereal. There is a current controversy surrounding ultra-processed foods because it provokes conversation concerning the correlation it has to poor health outcomes and the difficulty in removing it from one's diet because of its addictive nature. However, such considerations can then call to attention topics such as autonomy with food selection, as well as the potential benefit to ultra-processed foods, like the fact they create affordable food options. Both sides of this debate will be spotlighted in this podcast as we try to answer the question, should the government place regulations on ultra-processed foods? As we dive into our argument, Zach will be debating the side of anti-ultra-processed regulations, while Michelle will argue the side of pro-ultra-processed regulations. I would like to start with the first question for Zach.
Yes.
The term asymmetric patronalism refers to the idea of helping people achieve goals while protecting them from themselves without limiting freedom of choice. An example would be a parent making a decision for their child to not allow them to ride a bike unless they wear a helmet. What makes you believe the government regulations on food would be a threat to autonomy rather than asymmetric patronalism, which is having good intentions for improving someone's behavior? In this scenario, we will be looking at the American's diet.
Yes. That's a really good question. And I'd also like to say, like, government regulations usually tend to go on just directing the population towards healthy eating habits. So, like, in that asymmetric paternalism. So there's an article, The Heritage Foundation by Darren Bass. He said, the government should not intervene in the most basic and private aspects of our lives, even if there's some indirect social costs. So what I think is that most intrusive governments, they have interventions to plan to nudge people into making healthier options. But if it fails, it would give them more of a motivation to improve higher taxation and food banning. An example of this, I would say, would be New York City's attempt to limit sugary drinks. So they use their asymmetric paternalism by encouraging healthier choices through calorie labeling or public awareness events. But when those sales failed, they reduced soda consumption. So they tried to ban the sale of sugary drinks larger than 16 ounces in restaurants and theaters. And this happened in 2012. There's another article, Barry Popkin. He also wrote an article on the impactful policies to reduce ultra-processed food in for healthier eating, and that there's a lack of subsidies. So in other countries, specifically in South America, there's purchasing of ultra-processed foods have decreased, but there's still a lack of affordable, healthier options. So I believe that this could carry over into the United States. So if you're going to have, like, a decreased ultra-processed food, you still need to increase the subsidies for improving the health. So in this case, I came up with the example of mentioning nutrition education just to give consumers more knowledge on their diet. So that's my answer to that question.
Yeah, I think that's a really good answer and a really different way of looking at regulating ultra-processed foods. Thank you, Zach. So my next question is for Michelle. As we analyze different food categories across different global regions, ultra-processed food sales have grown in almost all regions of the world, given that sample foods such as whole wheat bread, protein bars, and plant-based milk alternatives could be classified as ultra-processed foods. How can we fairly determine which foods should be regulated?
Well, I'm going to start off by giving another shout out to Jack. That was a really good response, and you're already setting the standard pretty high. But let me say my piece. So I'm going to preface this by saying that I think my overarching answer would be to follow the government guidelines that already has place. And what I mean by prefacing it, I know that's a bit of a controversial take because, for one, it is a pretty broad answer to just say make healthy choices and just eat healthy, and to make it a strict standard of, yeah, there's healthy versus unhealthy, and all the foods that don't fall into the healthy category, they can just be like go off somewhere.
Right.
And along with speaking of the government, I know that's also pretty controversial, even as myself as an advocacy for putting regulations on. I do know that with some of the things that the government promotes for Americans' diets, it may not be for the pure intentions of keeping America healthy and rather money grab, but that is a different topic that we can get into on the next podcast. Stay tuned. But yeah, going back to like the regulations that the government already has, there are what I would like to call quote-unquote markers of unhealthiness. So we can turn into the USDA guidelines, and they do lay out specific markers of what would make a food healthy to be sustainable in a diet. So some of these guidelines, they start off with recommended daily intake, or RDA, and they have these categories of, for like the different macronutrients and micronutrients, of how many you should be hitting a day to be not seeing any deficiencies or to not get toxicity from eating too much. And so foods that go above recommended intake in certain macronutrients or micronutrients, example, like if a salty food already has 100% or 110% of the daily value in one serving, that's a lot, and you're already going above how much you should be recommended to take in salt for that day in one serving. And another example would be if a serving doesn't go above recommended percent in a day, it can be unbalanced. And for example, like for this is an easy one, for carbs, you know, there are a lot of carb dense foods, and sometimes the foods can go above how much you're supposed to eat in one day for that food alone. And it gets pretty tricky because diving into the specifics of the macro micronutrients, like that can be pretty that could be a nuance, but I think it's a good place to start. And another thing I'd say is foods, I think this is my second biggest point, foods that have an addictive nature. This was already introduced in the introduction of this top or of this podcast, where certain foods are pretty addictive, to say the least. And there's a study done by, I believe his name is Fazina, and he was doing a research study on the effects of hyperpalatable foods on energy and weight gain. If you don't know what hyperpalatable foods are, it's basically foods that have a good taste, you know, foods that I don't know a better way to describe it, but just to say that they taste good. And these foods can have effects on weight gain, where it causes an increased hedonic eating. And what that means is eating for the sake of pleasure rather than for the intuitive part and listening to your hunger signals.
Yeah.
And I think that's probably one of the main concerns I have when it comes to ultra processed foods, because it's a very enjoyable thing to eat, it becomes very easy to eat a lot of it. And, you know, you hear people talking about diets where, you know, you just have to keep everything in moderation. You can have a cookie, you know, you don't have to cut out all these unhealthy foods out of your diet as long as you eat it in moderation. But that can be, like, impossible for some people to do because they have, these foods are specifically engineered to be addictive.
Yeah.
And it can be a problem when people are eating these foods in high amounts.
Nice. Really good answer.
Yeah, that is very good. I think you guys did a great job answering that and showing us that there are these studies, and every study is different, and I think that shows the importance of this topic especially.
Mm-hmm.
So I want to turn the floor back over to Zach, and I just kind of want to hit on this quick little topic. So individuals with diabetes struggle with hypoglycemia, which is an uncontrolled decrease in blood sugar. One way to combat this is to have a sugar intake. While certain ultra-processed foods contain high amounts of sugar, that would be beneficial in treating low blood sugar crashes. The same treatment effect can be done with real foods that contain natural sugars. Wouldn't ultra-processed foods be unnecessary then, if real foods are a substitution? I'm very sorry.
That's okay.
substantial option.
Yeah. So I'll make this brief because we're running low on time here. But I would say that, so I got this information from the Mayo Clinic. They're a pretty reliable source based on health. So they say that the certain ultra-processed foods are very convenient and they have long expiration dates. So I feel like those that's a necessary factor. Also that they're the fast-acting carbs, so like their blood sugar management is very accurate. So they also suggest that there are certain gels and juices and other types of foods that have variable sugar measures and may be effective in urgent episodes. So I would say they list some examples here. So like Gatorade, Powerade, those juice boxes that you see, that they're all ultra processed. You also have Pop-Tarts and Rice Krispie treats. So they recommend candy and all this stuff just because they know it's fast acting, and in like an urgent situation, it could really balance those sugar levels. So what I would say, like restricting these access to these items, it will reduce the flexibility in managing these hypoglycemia episodes, and especially in emergency. So people mostly rely on the convenience and the portability of these products. Mm. So without them, they'd face unnecessary barriers and they wouldn't be able to manage their health more effectively when, like, every second counts in this situation. So that would be my answer to that question.
Yeah, of course. And I think also going off that question, I want to throw it back to Michelle. So for lower income families that tend to purchase ultra processed food because they provide more calories per the U.S. dollar, and it just makes it more cost effective for feeding these families, with the regulations of ultra-processed food, is it ethical to impose additional financial burdens on those who already struggle to afford food rather than conforming food accessible?
Yeah, that is a great point to bring up, because I can recognize that there are several barriers to eating healthy, not just how much income someone is making, but there's also time, there's also lack of knowledge, and but I think there are solutions, and some of my solutions were based off of Michael Pollan. He is a highly esteemed nutritionist in the food science and food politics world, and these are some of the solutions, along with some of my own original solutions that he proposed to this problem. So one of them is turning to the government. I know that has been as much as it may not be the end-all, be-all solution, and I 100% am not saying let's just put all our trust in the government, okay? But they do have a lot of nutrition assistance programs, and it doesn't just apply to buying processed foods. You can buy real foods with these programs. So some of them listed are SNAP, which we did talk about in class, and there are some problems with that. But there are other ones. There is Women, Infants, and Children's Program, or the WIC. There's Child and Adult Care Food Program. There's Senior Farmers Market Nutrition Program. And more relatable and more relevant to us college students here in Marquette, Marquette does have a backpacking program where they do offer groceries to people in need. And so besides going to these government assistance programs or schools assistance programs, my second point I'm going to make is the importance of planning. There are, despite the barriers that there are in eating healthy, I feel like with a strong plan and working out the details of what works and what doesn't work, and I think it's also important to recognize, like, with more money, it is easier to not have to put as much time into planning and not have to be as restrictive or as tedious when it comes to the details of your plan. But I think this can be applicable to everyone where, if you make a solid plan, let me even discuss like what the plan I'm talking about. I'm just saying planning. I think one of the most important ones for me is to learn how to cook. Learn how to cook on your own. Learn how to cook with your own ingredients at home. And you can utilize the internet. It's a very powerful tool. You can find free recipes online. You can find healthy options. You can find places where they have discounted deals. You can find coupons. You can find join the grocery store rewards programs, get deals off. And although it's hard as a beginner, you are starting from scratch, it is possible to learn. Again, like, the internet is very powerful, and there are free options of people having recipes, people doing cooking videos, people having instructions of how to prepare a budget-friendly high calorie or high nutrition content meal. And it doesn't have to feel as restrictive, you know. There are a lot of options out there, and I think you could still create a cost-effective health plan with proper planning.
Definitely.
Yeah, so I definitely have points from both you guys that I completely agree with, and I think you guys did a great job this debate. Thank you for that. So now that actually concludes our questions on this debate. So I just want to thank both Michelle and Zach for diving deeper and sharing the pros and cons of the government creating regulations on ultra-processed foods. With this topic being so important and opinion-based, we want everyone listening to be able to create their own opinion on if the government should create regulations on ultra-processed foods. We hope you can all take into account both sides of our arguments and create your own reasonings and opinions to this topic and allow yourself to learn more about the importance of this topic. And if ever asked, should the government place regulations on ultra-processed foods, you can allow yourself to answer in whatever way feels right. And hopefully you can just think back to our podcast and both of our debates that we've had today to help you form your opinion and your decision on this topic.
Yeah. All right. So that concludes the show, The Lounge, for this weekend. Just thank Angelina and Michelle for coming on.
Thank you, Zach. Yeah. Thank you, Zach.
And thanks for all the listeners, as always, for tuning in and stuff. Mm-hmm. But, I hope everyone has a good rest of your morning, Saturday morning. Enjoy the senior bar crawl. And, we'll see everyone next week. So, bye. Mm-hmm.